This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And today our show is going to start on a somewhat serious but important note. We are, after all, in the midst of a pandemic. We've been reading about people's lives having been lost due to the COVID-19 virus that is wreaking havoc everywhere, including the United States. And we thought it would be useful to remind people that sometimes there are choices that have to be made when we're confronted by a crisis or an end-of-life decision that can be worked out before it becomes imperative. Nancy Joyner is the president of Honoring Choices North Dakota, and she joins us today to talk about advanced care planning, what's sometimes referred to as a health care directive. Nancy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's do a little background here. What is Honoring Choices?
Honoring Choices is a spinoff from Respecting Choices, which is kind of our mothership, and there are numerous ones throughout the country. Our focus is specifically about having conversations about what people want, what matters most for them, especially in times of serious illness or if they're not able to make their own decisions. Who would make that decision for them and what kind of things that they may want?
And how did you become involved?
I have been a palliative care nurse for many years. Really found that praxis so many times when I'm meeting with people is how important conversation is to have true understanding of what's going on and what people's options are, you know, what are our choices, because we are the healthcare experts and a lot of times it's hard to know what kind of choices are out there. But what's more important is what matters most, that each individual has their own wishes, preferences, you know, beliefs, everything that they tie in together to make those decisions possible for them.
So Honoring Choices, the name of the organization, is the mission of the organization too.
Exactly.
So let's talk a bit about the ways this can be done. I went online to honoringchoicesnd.org, and there's a lot of information up there. One thing that we can talk about, just to sort of set the stage here, is advanced care planning. What is it, and when should people do it?
We recommend it anytime you're over 18, and that it should be done periodically from that point on. The American Bar Association even recognizes what they call the 5Ds. So every decade of somebody's life, that should be a time for checking in to see where you are with things. If you have a divorce or some kind of change in your family situation, a new birth of a child, et cetera, that would be the second D. Anytime that you do experience death and your reflection on that, if you become sick with a new disease or diagnosis is another time to be looking at it. And then the last one, which both people wait for, is the decline in status, which we don't want people to wait that long. It always seems too early until it's too late. So by the time you're 18, there on, we think it's time for reflection on that. And by advanced care planning, the end result hopefully would be to have like a healthcare directive. But by care planning, it means that we are having those conversations with our medical team. Where are we right now?
Let's talk about who should be doing this. You know, it's the individual, obviously, over 18, but is that something I just do by myself? Or do I need some professional, certified person to talk to?
We have a lot of facilitators throughout the state of North Dakota that have actually been trained on how to develop the trust, the rapport, what kind of things you should be thinking about to have that conversation with other family members, who you would want to have, like the healthcare agent, and definitely with your physician or provider or people that you work with, so that everybody's on the same page.
Well, it's one thing to independently ponder a healthcare directive for yourself. When might it be advisable to recommend it to someone else?
It's very important, especially when a person has any kind of illness that has occurred. You know, and right now with our time of COVID, there might be a lot of medical issues that may come up. And our biggest thing is the who. If something were to happen to you, is there someone that would know what your wishes are and what that you would want done dependent on the circumstances if certain things happen? Even if you were in a car accident tonight, unable to make decisions, who is that person that would be able to make decisions for you? The what changes all the time because we don't know what's ahead for people and what's there. But there's certain things we always ask about, specifically CPR, having going into the intensive care unit, having dialysis, those type of things that may come up as far as medical interventions, because we do have them. 50 years ago, these kinds of questions wouldn't come up, but now they're needed.
I have noticed one change in terms of modern medicine, besides the 15-minute increment that the physicians follow these days, is that this question is routinely asked when I go in to see the doctor. I'm asked, do I have a healthcare directive? And I've been able to say for the last 5 years, I do. That's become, I suspect, something that is rather uniform in terms of professionals in the healthcare business.
That is true. And we definitely would do it after a person reaches the age of like 40 or 50. But even earlier, something can happen to someone. That's why we say the earlier you can have conversations, the better it would be. One of my bucket list things would be to have it in high school during life skills class when you're learning about financial wills, and that you could be able to have other ones as well, too.
Well, what are the choices we're talking about here? What are the things we should be thinking about in an advanced care planning document?
The first thing is always the person that you would want to speak for you if you're not able to speak for yourself. It's been shown that, you know, that there can be that time between medications or being overwhelmed or something that you want another person to be able to talk on your behalf or with you. And so that's the number one thing that we always would want to know. The second thing, of course, is how far, how much somebody would want. And the first question is always the CPR question, resuscitation. If something were to happen, if your heart was to stop and you're not breathing, would you want us to attempt resuscitation or allow natural death, because death has occurred if your heart stops and you're not breathing?
Nancy Joyner is the president of Honoring Choices North Dakota. We're talking about advanced care planning. That's a healthcare directive. And you mentioned the importance of having somebody who represents you, because sometimes we're in a medical circumstance where we really can't talk for ourselves. I have this directive, as I mentioned, and it talks about resuscitation. It talks about hydration. It talks about dialysis. It talks about my wishes about organ donation. It also talks about the final disposition of my remains. It's pretty comprehensive.
There are many out there. There are everything from, in our state, as long as it's notarized or you have two witnesses and one person is not going to be making any decisions on your behalf, be it either the medical person or your healthcare agent, that would be acceptable. But those are the usual questions that do come up. There are also ones that can be done. We have some on our website of what we call our short form, which is only a one-page, very quick document that we recommend for people that are healthy, you know, between the ages of like 18 and 40, don't have other health issues going on, versus all the other kind of things that may come up. But there's so much to be considered at any time when you get into a medical emergency that it's important to have these discussions before that occurs.
And of course, this healthcare agent is critically important, but I think some people might be a bit apprehensive about something like a healthcare directive or advanced care planning like this, forgetting that if you're cognizant, if you're awake, if you can have a conversation with a physician or the healthcare provider, you override anything that's written down.
Absolutely. The only time that the healthcare directive would go into place is if you cannot speak for yourself. However, a lot of people will say, let's refer to it and discuss it and see if we need to update it, which is sometimes a nice thing to do as well. But it is important to know that you always have the right, and you always have the right to change your mind too, which is another important thing to know.
Well, it also, as I mentioned, goes into some detail, and I can just mention in my particular case the bit of detail that I have about ventilation. And it says, I wish to receive ventilation as an intervention during an emergency or for a reasonable amount of time if required for a treatment, procedure, or medication. Ventilation should not be used as a permanent treatment option. That's my choice.
And that's a very common choice that people have, that there's a check-in time, that we do a treatment goal and a time-limited component of it to see where we are with things. Is this improving? Is this condition that can be reversible or get you back to your stable condition that you were in prior to your health change?
Are there circumstances when a choice might not be honored?
We're hoping that that never happens. That gets to be the issue at when was it last reviewed? And sometimes I have come across people that have a healthcare directive that they haven't even looked at for 10 years. And so it needs to be reviewed and see if it's still appropriate to the situation. And again, can somebody make that change at that point in time?
Now, I can go online and find a form for a simple will. Is that possible for an advanced care planning document?
Yes, there are many of them out there. They even have one that is an app now called My Directives that is permissible in our state of North Dakota. Five Wishes has been used. There's some throughout the state. You can go online and just look for a North Dakota healthcare directive. And so there are many different ones that are out there.
Now, how uniform is it among states? Because obviously a lot of people in North Dakota might have a summer place in Minnesota, or they might winter in Arizona. How uniform are these standards across the country?
It pretty much they are a standard thing. It is a legal document because it is, like I said, it requires two signatures or a notary, but this is stating your wishes and that it is that way so that they will be honored, hopefully, when you travel from place to place. In fact, one of the attorneys I talked to recommended keeping a copy in your glove compartment. Literally does travel with you for those that are snowbirds, etc. Other people keep them with other documents, but we recommend not just keeping it in your safety deposit box, where not always where it would be. We want to make sure that you have a copy with you. Nowadays with electronics, we recommend even putting them on a flash drive or a thumb drive that can carry it with you and make sure that it is updated as you need it.
Well, it's on file with my primary care provider, and of course I'm with a system, so the system knows what my advanced care planning directives are. And I have several people that I listed on my document as those people who could be my healthcare agents. For example, my children, they have copies of it. And I have a couple myself that if I need to, I can give to somebody. But I went online to honoringchoicesnd.org, and I saw something else up there, another acronym, POLST, Physician Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. What's the difference?
They're cousins of each other. They complement each other. One is talking for the future. The POLST translates somebody's medical wishes. It's a voluntary, like a medical order, into actual medical orders that an EMS can respond to. A medical person would not be able to respond directly to that. It would take the doctor to write it as an order for anything that's written in the healthcare directive itself. Those are the main differences between the two. But we do recommend that is another thing to be thinking about. It's only for people that are seriously ill, nearing the end of life, frail, you know, those type of things that may be coming up. It's not for the everyday person. And it's put into place, as I said, it's a portable medical order that transfers with that person wherever they are. And it's used for today. Sign it off today. You might change your mind and have a different order tomorrow.
So if you're admitted to a long-term care facility, would you perhaps hear somebody ask you if you were interested in a POLST?
Yes, they probably would ask you about both of these. The first one would be the document if you're not able to speak for yourself, but what would you want if something were to happen tonight? What are your wishes that you would want? Again, it addresses the idea of CPR and resuscitation. The other things you talked about would you want to be going back to the hospital? Would you want us to be able to manage your care in the nursing home now? The hydration, nutrition component that you have, who would be speaking for you if you're not able to speak for yourself? But what would you want tonight so that we have it as an order?
Now, you mentioned that it's important to talk to the people that you designate as your healthcare agents about your wishes and perhaps give them a copy of the document and review what your decisions have been. Is that designated healthcare agent, a spouse or son or daughter or friend or whoever it is, legally bound to abide by that document?
That's the whole idea. When you choose the person that you want somebody that's going to be able to represent you, to honor your wishes, not to be fearful if you're put in a time of crisis, that they're still going to be able to take on that role. So it's important to ask them to be able to do that role. Because some people say, no, that's not for me. And so it doesn't always necessarily have to be a family member. It might be a very close friend or somebody that knows your wishes better than somebody else. Otherwise, by law, if you have not designated somebody, we do go by what we call our century code and go by people within your family, the closest relatives, et cetera.
Now, you mentioned this earlier, but has the COVID-19 pandemic affected the need or demand for these kinds of documents?
It's kind of scary, but, you know, when things get right down to it, we do need to know what people's wishes are if they're not going to be able to talk to us or have those conversations. So it has put a more of a push on it, but we don't want it to be fearful or anything like that. We'd rather have it in a more comfortable, earlier status, but there is more need at this point in time.
And it is a viral respiratory disease, and we have heard lots of people sometimes in advanced cases require respirators. That's ventilation. Probably would be helpful to be somewhat specific about that.
Right, and that's an important thing. You know, what are your options to know? And even though a person may choose not to go on a ventilator, they can still be kept comfortable and to see if they're able to gain their own strength back versus if they're going towards nearing the end of life.
What are the possible ramifications of not having a healthcare directive?
The biggest thing is, by default, we will do everything and everything possible, you know, because we are good Samaritans and we'll try to do everything where people may or may not want something done or how long and how much. The other big thing is that if you're not able to speak for yourself, it then goes to the family who could be in this crisis mode and not knowing what somebody's wishes are and never had the conversation at all.
Well, let's talk about a really difficult part of this whole discussion, and that is personal finances. Healthcare is not inexpensive, and sometimes even if the healthcare intervention is sort of covered as an emergency and maybe you have to go on Medicaid or whatever, it can get in the way of your other wishes, maybe that will you had, which was to leave significant money, you hoped, to some relative, you know, your spouse or your children, leaving that to others instead of sustaining a painful or depressing existence. That's sort of tied up in this, isn't it?
It is, but it's very sad because that is not a responsibility from a healthcare perspective. You know, we do know that it is an industry, but we're always there to try to honor a person's wishes to the best we can. You know, and when people say they want everything done, we don't know financially what that's going to entail as well for them, as you were just stating.
But that's where that decision, that personal decision, kind of gets tied up in that will thing too, because people spend their entire lives accumulating a certain amount of wealth, and their desire might be, I want to hand this down to my descendants. And at what point do I weigh that decision and decide it's better that I not sustain this life to better sustain another?
And that's a very hard, difficult decision. And that's one of the things why we have facilitated discussions earlier, so that people put all these things in perspective. What matters most? What are your values? What's your belief systems? All of that in perspective. Because healthcare is an industry, as we know, but we still are going to do everything we can within our capacity to the best we can.
Well, let me get into that very difficult ultimate question, because some states have made this decision, Oregon famously. Is assistance to end life a reasonable option for some? And would that ever find its way into an advanced care planning document?
Only certain states have that as a perspective. The one thing that we do have in every state is the ability to have people kept comfortable with sedation and allowing the natural process from there. It's legal in every state, but it is not hastening the death or the death with dignity in that respect.
Hydration, for example. That decision in your document would accelerate your demise if you chose under certain circumstances to just discontinue hydration.
That's true. It depends on your body maybe declining, and if you keep hydrating, your body may work against it too. There gets to be that point where it's not beneficial to the body if you're at that point nearing the end of life.
These are difficult decisions to be made, which is, I suppose, underscores the need to make them when you can. I thank you for spending some time walking us through the weeds here a bit, Nancy.
It's been an honor. I've been hopefully helpful and really encourage people to go to our website, as you mentioned, the Honoring Choices North Dakota. If you just Google North Dakota Healthcare Directives, Honoring Choices, et cetera, you should be able to find us.
Nancy Joyner is the president of Honoring Choices North Dakota. More Main Street in a moment.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. The question why is very empowering. It's about the divine, it's about the moral, it's about the pleasurable, it's about fear. Why is everything? I'm not very good with authority and I'm not very good with limits. And so I like a question that gives me the ability to do whatever I want, whenever I want. I was born and raised in Manhattan on the edge of a neighborhood that most people would know as Spanish Harlem. I ended up in North Dakota because they offered me a job. It's that simple. And we've had a very good life here so far. Dispel these myths. Philosophy is boring. I guess I would ask you to ask yourself, are you boring? Do you think you have nothing of interest to offer anybody? You are philosophy. Philosophy is you. Everything you ask, everything you think, everything you want, everything you strive for, this is what makes up philosophy. Philosophy itself is compelling enough and exciting enough that it is pretty much the oldest discipline. And philosophers had more influence on the world than almost anybody. Plato, Aristotle, we live in their world. And so if you want to make philosophy exciting, you have to be exciting. Philosophy majors can't get jobs or make any money. Philosophy is the highest paid major of all of the humanities, and the rate of return is actually the same over a lifetime as engineering. Listen to Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life, every second Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Around the world and in the U.S., leaders are weighing the delicate balance between struggling economies and public health concerns with a pandemic that remains out of control. Mark Trahant, editor of Indian Country Today, offers some perspective with a look back to the Spanish flu pandemic.
Human nature has not changed much. A century ago in 1920, the influenza pandemic had been raging for 2 years. The country was tired of social distancing and the rules that enforced public health orders. People wanted to look forward to brighter days. And by the fall of 1919, the flu had all but disappeared from the news of the day. But the first month of 1920 was rough. Dorothy Ann Petit, in a 1976 doctoral dissertation, A Cruel Wind, American Experiences, Pandemic Influenza, 1918-1920, A Social History, wrote that, by February, the pandemic had clearly returned. Indian country was hit hard in 1920. American Indians suffered from epidemic influenza in the early months of 1920, much as they had in previous deadly wave of the disease, wrote Dorothy Pettit. By 1920, the epidemic started to change society in dramatic ways. Congress did appropriate funds in 1920 for the expansion of nurses and doctors. That, too, is a legacy that reached Indian country. There was a pipeline beginning for women to go from Haskell and Hampton schools into further education or into basic nursing. One Haskell graduate, Lutyant, wrote her friend Louise in 1918 from her new station in Washington, D.C. She said, "As many as 90 people die every day with the flu. Soldiers are dying by the dozens. So far, Felicity, C. Zane, and I are the only Indian girls who have not had it. We certainly consider ourselves lucky." She said the work was hard. "Believe me," she wrote, "we were always glad when night came because we sure did get tired. We had the actual practical nursing to do, just like the other nurses had, and were given a number of wards with 3 or 4 patients in each to look after them." She told her friend about living in Washington, D.C., a beautiful place. "But the place is closed on account of the flu," she added. "All the schools, churches, theaters, dancing halls are closed here." A decade later, the first nursing school was established for American Indians at Sage Memorial School of Nursing in the Navajo Nation in Ganado, Arizona. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, postcards from the Prairie podcaster Eliza Blue talks about her new book, Accidental Rancher. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A task force is hoping to have some recommendations for Governor Burgum on a phased plan to allow family members to visit their loved ones who are in long-term care facilities. But the chairman of the task force says it's not going to be a free-for-all.
It's not going to be like we're releasing everything, you can open up your facilities wide. No.
Christopher Larson chairs the Reuniting Residents and Families Task Force. He's a resident of a Mayville nursing home. He says he likes Governor Burgum's phased approach in opening things up, and a working group will be hammering out some initial guidance to present to Burgum this week.
We know that how important this is to North Dakota, and I just want people to know that I'm taking my position as chairman of this committee very seriously. You know, being a resident in long-term care, that's very important to me. It's going to take time, but the end goal in this group is for families to be reunited with their loved ones in a safe but yet systematic manner.
The task force has representatives of long-term care facilities and residents, the State Human Services Department, and a number of state legislators. The people behind Minnesota's smoking prevention efforts say they won't let up, even though they've seen a major victory this legislative session. The Tobacco 21 bill, signed by Governor Tim Walz, raises the state's tobacco buying age to 21. Laura Smith with Clearway Minnesota says the group is happy leaders still found time to adopt the measure given the COVID-19 crisis. However, she says it's just one part of a four-point plan.
We also need to look at the price of tobacco products. We need to look at flavors available, and we need to look at prevention funding.
Smith says youth vaping is still a major health issue and says banning flavored tobacco would be a huge boost.
Making sure that we can clear the market of flavored tobacco products in Minnesota, because we know that flavors really attract kids, and especially when it comes to the vaping epidemic.
The 2019 Minnesota Student Survey found that more than 1 in 4 11th graders and more than 1 in 10 8th graders had used e-cigarettes in the previous month. From 2016 to 2019, 8th grade vaping rates nearly doubled. Smith hopes lawmakers will at least consider a flavored tobacco ban to discourage youth vaping when they meet in a special session this summer. Opponents of these efforts say they go too far and could harm smaller retailers while creating a market of unregulated products. And making sure all kids are counted is a common theme for the 2020 census. The number of young children missed in previous counts has grown steadily, and North Dakota officials worry about those in American Indian families. North Dakota officials say more than 800 children across the state were not included in the 2010 count. It's a concern on reservations where many residents get their mail through P.O. boxes. This year, with sheltering in place during the pandemic, they may not have received the census forms that were mailed out. To address outreach interruptions, the state is doing more advertising through social media. And last year, it set aside $1 million for census awareness efforts. Kevin Iverson, who heads the census office at the North Dakota Commerce Department, says that helped boost the number of complete count committees, including in tribal areas.
We didn't have that last time around. So there is a recognition at the local area in the tribes that they're impacted and their undercount has hurt them.
North Dakota tribes hope a more accurate count will lead to a wider representation for their members. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I'm Eric Detheridge for Prairie Public, and you may have noticed on our social media feeds and website we have been asking, what's the first place you'll go when it's time to go out and eat again?
My name is Candace Steed Rasmussen, and we live outside of Arisca, North Dakota. And answering a question regarding where we will be going when we have our first meal out. And we will be going to Sevier's in Valley City. It's where my husband and I always go for special celebrations. And it's comfortable. The people are wonderful. Nam and his lovely wife just have a wonderful, wonderful restaurant. They have even better food than wonderful. The atmosphere is wonderful. You can see Valley City from up on the hill there. I realize I'm saying wonderful a lot. Well, that's what Sabir's is. And what's really worth celebrating for us is Nam flies fresh seafood in every weekend, Friday and Saturday dinner. And that's worth celebrating. Thank you.
Well, Candace is not the first one to say Sabir's there in Valley City is pretty wonderful. In fact, there are other eateries that show up on our list of first places to go more than once. You can check out the full list, in fact. See where your friends and neighbors are itching to go when the time feels right at prairiepublic.org and click on the big banner that says First Place I'll Go. The First Place I'll Go on Prairie Public is sponsored in part by Bremer Bank.
Suddenly I'm always shouting. My tongue is banging like a drum. My thoughts are running wild. Every one of them. child. No, I'm spending too much time alone. My desperation makes me bold.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public, and that's music by Eliza Blue from her album South Dakota, First of May. We featured her podcasts, Postcards from the Prairie, and we'll have another for you later in today's show, but we'll lead into that with some background about Eliza. When she first visited South Dakota, she didn't think she'd stay long. She was a suburban woman and a successful folk musician. She had gigs and albums. And why would she plant roots in remote northwestern South Dakota, raising chickens and herding sheep? Eliza explains in a conversation with South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Lori Walsh as they discuss her new book, Accidental Rancher.
Eliza, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It is so exciting to get this book in my hands. I'm excited for you. I'm excited as a reader. I'm excited to sort of have this flag planted as a voice in South Dakota. How has it felt for you to sort of unpack that box for the first time?
Obviously, this is a very strange time that we're living through anyway. So that almost has, I guess, kind of superseded it, because we were actually, the book was going to be officially released in June, and we were going to do a whole book tour and all kinds of stuff. And with things being as they are, we just decided we'll just release it and we'll just see how the rest of the summer unfolds. And in the meantime, people that are needing to stay home can have something to read now.
When Magna Chakrabarty on On Point was talking last week, I think it was, about books that you're reading in the pandemic, though, that was the thing that I tweeted out and said, this is what I think people need to be reading, because when I sit with it, it is this touchstone to a reality that we all live here in South Dakota, even if we don't ranch or we don't have your exact life. There's a universality to what you're writing about. It brought peace. It brought a sense that hard times have come before and they will come again. There was a lot in there for people, and that feels like an opportunity for this book, as well as sort of an obstacle to letting people know about it. We've been through hard things before.
I mean, it's interesting, too, because, you know, not to be sort of being lighthearted about something that's pretty serious, but our life on a ranch is kind of like the life that everyone has been leading in quarantine.
yep. You know,
because we are so remote, and especially this time of year when the sheep and the cows are having their babies, we really need to be here pretty much all the time. And that's true just, you know, for our neighbors as well. So everyone sticks very close to home. Obviously, there's not a lot of commerce that happens anyway in rural America. It's just a very different lifestyle. My sister, she lives in Minnesota, and soon after they had their shelter in place order come through, she called me up and she was like, "This is what you've been training for." she was like asking for tips, you know, what do you do when you have to stay home? And most of us have relatives, probably not even that distantly. If you don't live on a ranch now, you probably had somebody in your family tree that not that long ago had to essentially kind of do it all from home. And so it is something that we aren't used to. I certainly wasn't before I moved here. I figured it out, and in doing so found quite a lot of gifts to that, put in quotes, slower pace of life, because it's not really slower. It's just a different kind of busy.
It's not slow. As I look at the things that you're doing, I kind of was sitting in my backyard going, I'm a lightweight compared to Eliza's chore list. I've got a tortoise that I have to take care of, and that's the animal husbandry that's happening here, and that's about it. But one of the things that you address in this book and one of the essays, and I want to jump also to this New York Times opinion piece that you just had published. But first, in Accidental Rancher, there's a part where you talk about how connected people in a neighborhood are and how, you know, the keys might be left in the car because somebody might have an emergency and that would be your neighbor. You know, that doesn't work in the city of Sioux Falls or it doesn't work in some of these other places. But there's a message there for when you are isolated and you can't run to the store for something, that you start looking to the people around you. And I think that's a lesson that a lot of people during the pandemic have had their eyes opened to a little bit. Was that new for you to come to Perkins County and then to realize that everybody kind of already knows who you are, even though you haven't introduced yourself? You're all connected automatically out of necessity and tradition. What was that transition like for you?
It was sort of shocking in a really good way when I first moved out here. It was just, I mean, yeah, I'd only lived in big cities, and I was used to anonymity. You know, you go to a coffee shop, you go to the grocery store, like maybe every once in a blue moon you'd run into someone you know, but mostly you're just kind of passing through. And then you live in a small town and it's just, I mean, you never are. It's a yeah. really big difference. But it's also interesting to me that living in a small town, you end up actually knowing and being connected to way more people than when you live in a city that's full of millions of people. I mean, it's just so surprising how the fact that you're supposedly more isolated geographically actually results in you being much more connected. My husband, you know, he grew up in this town. He lived away for a while, but this is his home. The number of funerals that he goes to in a year is kind of shocking to me even now, but it's because, I mean, he knows everybody and everybody knows him. And it's, again, when you're in a city, I think you're much more likely to be sort of in a group of peers, whether it's through occupation or generational, and you just don't have the different kind of generational connections that you have in a small town, and you certainly don't have the kind of roots where you just know that people are going to step up when you need them. That just doesn't happen in the same way in cities. For me, yeah, moving out here, it was wonderful to suddenly experience this safety net that I had never had before in my life. It really is one of my favorite things about living here.
Yeah. You wrote for the New York Times about the food supply chain, life on the ranch during the pandemic. And you said ranchers know what the problems are. And we know what it's like to see our businesses close. We know what it's like to cut down to essential services. Why did you write that piece? And what was the response from it?
One of the biggest reasons that I felt compelled to write it was because I was seeing a lot of discussion about the food supply chain. But again, by virtue of, you know, most media outlets are in cities, which makes sense, and there's good reason why that's the case. But then, you know, it's sort of necessarily the journalists writing about these topics are also city dwellers. If they do kind of come out to the countryside, it's going to be for a relatively short amount of time. And so therefore, it's just going to, again, necessarily be somewhat anecdotal. And so I was just reading a lot of people writing about us, but who probably don't have an opportunity to really spend time or have a background in agriculture. So basically just sent an email to the New York Times, like unsolicited to their general account, like, I think you should consider having some voices of people who actually are physically working in the food supply chain. To their credit, they wrote me back right away and they agreed. It's hard. And this I also said in the email I sent them, you know, when we live rurally, we have to physically be here to do this work. So we can't travel to the city, and it's harder to kind of make connections with people working in journalist fields. It just makes it that much harder to have our voices heard. I was very thankful and appreciative that some random person sent them an email and they took the time to read it and then to publish it. But I hope that more diverse voices from people who are actually working in the field of agriculture can be a part of this conversation, because what we are finding is that there are some real issues and fragility in our current system. And those of us working in this field we have been experiencing that for a while, but it hadn't yet trickled out, I think, to the greater population. So it wasn't as obvious that there were problems.
I think you used the word brittle at some point,
yes.
An exploitive structure, and that, you know, how the pandemic has revealed that, and even just what you were saying there, how the pandemic has revealed how often people talk about us without talking with us or listening to us. Some of that has been revealed. What needs to happen next?
Specifically at a grassroots level, first of all, there's some great organizations that already exist that are doing great work, like Dakota Resources and Dakota Rural Action. I just hope they continue to gain traction. And if this is a topic you're interested in, those are great organizations to look into. And then similarly, I mean, there's already a lot of people sort of working to promote farmers markets, doing direct marketing of products, making it so that there is a local supply chain as well. That stuff already existed, and I'm hoping that will just grow. And with the internet, which is pretty exciting, like you can just Google producers in my area or how do I buy meat from a rancher, and there's a lot of resources right. to help you. I hope that those movements will continue to spread, because I do think that just in general, raising awareness is like an important first step. And then from there, there's a lot of people to get fed, basically. So I think that the supply chain is going to be longer than just you show up in someone's yard and they hand you some meat or like some vegetables. There's going to be, I hope anyway, at least a little bit more diversity and more options for consumers. And that because there will be more options, that will lead to resilience. Right now, the problem we're having, like, for example, with Smithfield, is that one place was producing so much food that when they had to close down, it caused a gigantic backup in the system. Whereas if you have lots of different people finding lots of different ways to get their products out there, that's just going to be inherently more resilient. Because if one of those little avenues has to shut down for whatever reason, it doesn't stop the whole thing dead in its tracks.
My guest is Eliza Blue, and she has a new book out called Accidental Rancher. It's published by South Dakota Magazine Press. I love Katie Hunhoff's introduction or foreword to this book, where, you know, she's talking about these voices of South Dakota, people like Kathleen Norris and Linda Hazelstrom and Eliza Blue. And here you are. And like Linda Hazelstrom and like Kathleen Norris, one of the things that you're willing to do is to sit and look at your own life and to look at some very, very small things and figure out how to go deeply enough into that personal to find the universal. Tell me a little bit about being identified with writers like that as this first book is published, and I'm sure you'll have more.
They're definitely big shoes to fill, so it's flattering and a little intimidating. It's funny actually having this book out in the world. In my life as a musician, I released several albums, and so kind of know the cycle of how that goes. When you release something into the world, of course, your initial feeling is actually one of terror.
Yeah.
Like, oh gosh, now people are going to listen to it, or in this case, read it. And that actually feels sort of awful, which is ironic since that was the reason you spent years and years of your life trying to make it something that was shareable, I guess. That's just part of the creative process. It's an honor, and it's also very scary.
Well, I hope there will be many more books, and I want to say thank you for this one, and thank you for spending just a little bit of time with us today.
Oh, thank you.
Lori Walsh, host of South Dakota Public Radio's In the Moment, in a conversation with author and singer-songwriter Eliza Blue about her new book, Accidental Rancher. Here's more of Eliza from one of her podcasts, a postcard from the prairie feature about this year's lambing season.
The past few years, despite variations in planning, we've always managed to start lambing during terrible weather. Last year, it was a late blizzard. The year before, high wind and cold rain. In fact, one of the only times we've had our first lambs arrive on a nice day was the year the ram got out and we had accidental lambs during a February thaw. This year, however, we finally hit the weather jackpot. Sunny and beautiful with a light breeze. Perfect. I breathed a sigh of relief. Of course, as any shepherd will tell you, that was a naive thing to do. There's an old saying around here, lambs are born looking for a place to die, and that saying is still in use for a reason. Even with nice weather, there is plenty that can go wrong in the care and keeping of sheep. I will spare you the gory details of this year's fiascos and simply share a few bullet points. Twins tangled together trying to merge at the same time, a triplet stillborn and premature, a ewe with an infected udder, a lamb so lanky his body couldn't lift its own weight, a tiny lamb who fell ill, too weak even to swallow. And these were just the first few births. Since the rough beginning, the rush of calamities has eased, but my stress level has not. Even though most births this week went smoothly, every new baby's arrival felt like a new opportunity for tragedy. I frequently found myself standing in the lambing pasture, staring into the middle distance, afraid to leave lest something awful happen while I was away. In one case, my hypervigilance paid off. I awoke at 2 a.m. a few nights ago and went out to check the flock. I found Malka, one of my oldest and sweetest ewes, on the ground, her wet, shivering baby huddled on the other side of the pen, too cold and exhausted even to bleat. I tried to coax Malka up, but she merely kicked and shuddered, her eyes lolling wildly. I finally managed to heave Malka halfway to standing, at which point she did the rest, then shook herself off, completely recovered. She has been fine ever since. So perhaps you can understand why yesterday, when I saw one of my ewes shuddering and straining the points of two white hooves and a tiny pink nose emerging, I immediately went on high alert. An hour later, the ewe was still wandering around, laying down, then standing up and straining with no progress to show for her efforts. I started to panic. Now, ordinarily, my husband would have helped me catch and hold her while I tried to ease the baby out, but he was off the ranch for the day building fences. I waited a little longer, then I called my neighbor. I hated to bother him, but what else could I do? Well, just as my neighbor pulled up the driveway, my ewe gave a final push and out popped the biggest ram lamb I've ever seen. He was up and trying to find milk before my neighbor turned off his engine. "I'm so sorry," I said, cheeks bright with shame as I walked towards his vehicle. "That's okay," he told me, and I believe he meant it, but I still felt embarrassed and exhausted, and, if I'm being honest, a little like giving up altogether. Even on an easy year, when the births are mostly uncomplicated, the relentlessness of spring on a ranch is daunting. During years when things don't go smoothly, it's hard not to contemplate finding a less emotionally and physically taxing line of work. But, as my husband is fond of saying, it's a good life if you don't weaken. And so, we soldier on, watching and waiting and hoping for the best.
You can follow Eliza Blue and find out where she'll be performing by visiting elizablue.net. Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
African Soul, American Heart protects, educates, and empowers orphan girls from South Sudan. Sponsorship opportunities are available. Sponsors receive a picture and letter from the girl they sponsor and learn how her life has changed. Learn more at asahinsudan.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 26th. Peggy Lee was born on this date in 1920 in Jamestown, North Dakota. She's known for her singing, movie, and television career. She is not well known for her war with the Walt Disney Company. The case came about because Disney performers received no additional compensation when a movie was later shown on television and turned into video cassettes. The movie company received all of the profits. The 1955 animated film The Lady and the Tramp became a box office hit for Disney. Peggy voiced several of the characters and wrote six of the songs. The animators even embodied Peggy's stage performance in the attitude of the dog, Peg. Peggy earned a total of $4,500, a respectable amount in 1955. No one imagined the money that would be made in home entertainment. Peggy's contract with Disney said the company had no right to make phonograph records and/or transcriptions for sale to the public. In 1987, Disney released Lady and the Tramp on VHS and made a profit of $90 million. Disney offered Peggy a small sum for promotion of the video. Peggy was insulted by the amount and took the company to court in 1988. It seemed like a hopeless cause. Disney had an army of the best lawyers. Disney said that transcriptions referred to recordings, not copies of the movie. But Peggy's lawyer uncovered an old case in which Disney sued the Alaska Television Network for airing Disney movies without consent, and in that case, Disney defined transcriptions as copies. The argument persuaded the judge, and he ruled in favor of Peggy. And then it was time to decide on the amount of the damages. Peggy herself showed up to testify. By this time, she was frail and in a wheelchair, and she made a very sympathetic witness. Another witness was Jodie Benson, who voiced Ariel in The Little Mermaid. Disney expected her to testify that actors worked for Disney not for money, but for the prestige. Benson, however, found Peggy's testimony so compelling that she said Peggy deserved whatever the jury would give her. The jury awarded her $3.83 million. Peggy died in 2002 and was mourned by the music world. She was compared to Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald. Tony Bennett called her the female Frank Sinatra. But she was also the performer who took on Walt Disney and won. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
At distribution centers across the U.S., people are lining up in their cars for food.
The line has grown longer here.
And those who relied just a little on donations before the pandemic now rely on them a lot.
When your income just kind of got wiped out, snatched from you, I just thank God that we're able to get what we get.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street, and a reminder that we always stream our show as we broadcast at prairiepublic.org. And after the show has been broadcast, you can find the show as an archive at prairiepublic.org. Tomorrow on our show, we'll hear conversations on healthcare hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter in a discussion with engineer, data analyst, and Silicon Valley entrepreneur Thomas Pueyo. He's working to compare the approaches of different countries for containing the COVID-19 pandemic. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.